This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 216. I only saw seven of them, guys. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. This is yet another of our special shows, as Larry and I get together for the first time since the premiere of Star Trek Discovery to talk about what we've seen so far, where things may be going, and, of course, the business side of Trek. So let's step into the Ready Room. Well, hello, Larry. It's been a while since you've been here in the Ready Room, and a big event happened since then. Discovery premiered.
Oh, I thought you meant you'd remodeled. No.
Well, I did that
Discovery
too.
Yeah, Discovery, that thing. Yeah.
I did make a few additions to the Ready Room, Larry. First of all, I'd like to know, do you like my bowl of fortune cookies?
They're exceedingly crunchy. Is that an old family recipe of yours too, Chris? Or
it is.
You just
yes.
Pick these up at the nearest yen store or something.
You can get them there, but I prefer the family ones. We have a recipe; it's been in the family for generations. I come from a long line of fortune cookie bakers. On my father's side and on my mother's side, they have been writing the actual fortunes out for centuries.
Oh, okay. Well, if you were here with me, I would, I mean, if I thought to bring them along, I have a big, big, big stock of frozen blueberries that I could have brought with me, but I didn't.
Oh, I appreciate that. But I have to say, they don't taste quite the same as they do when I eat them on the train.
Or when you ate them in prison. But okay. Where are you going with this?
Well, so yes, I have my fortune cookies to my left. And then you may notice to the right, I also have a Tribble.
You're not feeding the Tribble the fortune cookies, are you?
No, because I want to keep just one Tribble.
Okay. I didn't know if you'd had it genetically, because you know, if you keep it a Tribble in isolation, it's okay as long as you don't, you know, feed it.
Yeah. Well, you know, as Bob Barker always said, be sure to have your Tribbles spayed and neutered.
Okay. Yes. Yes, he did. Because Bob was just a future thinking guy.
He really was, yeah.
He was spanning the ages.
All right. So it's been a while since we talked about Discovery, and we did it before the cons and, of course, before the premiere.
Wow. That was the ancient times.
Exactly. But it was at a point when we did have real news, so we could really speculate. And now that it's out, we've seen the first three episodes. I've seen each of them four times, and I think you've seen at least the third one 9,000 times, you told me, on the other side.
47,000 times, yeah.
47,000 times, yeah. We can actually talk about what we've seen. One thing that I've done, Larry, for our outline is I went back and I looked at our chapter titles from the last episode of The Ready Room when we discussed Discovery, and I've picked up a few of those so that we can talk about the same topics, but with actual information.
Compare and contrast, as it were.
That's right. Yes. That's actually the title of the sixth episode of Discovery, Larry. Compare and contrast.
Damn it. They told me not to mention it on the air. Okay. Just cut that out. Cut that out, Chris. We all got drunk at the premiere party and beforehand, and they said, whatever you do, don't mention that the sixth episode title is Compare and Contrast. CBS will fire all of us.
I know. And that's what always happens, though, when we get our hands on that Romulan ale.
You must edit that out, or else it will unalterably change the trajectory of history. It will alter the timeline. All those people losing their jobs.
You know, speaking of titles, I was talking to Bill from Trek Geeks on Twitter yesterday, and he said, as much as I want to catch up on Discovery podcasts and On the Edge, he means, here's hoping my commutes to and from work aren't that long. And I told him that the podcaster's mic cares not for the worker's time. All right. So let's get into some topics here, Larry. And we're going to start off with the business side of Discovery, because we've recorded so many episodes on the network where we're talking about the story and the episodes. And you and I always like to talk about the business side, because we both work in media and have for decades. And so we do think about these things a little bit differently than the average fan does. News came out this week from CBS that, as a result of Discovery, daily growth in All Access subscribers is up more than 200% year over year. And the president and COO of CBS Interactive, Marc DeBevoise, said that consumer response to the launch of Star Trek Discovery has been tremendous. The build-up to the show's premiere led us to a record-setting month, week, and ultimately day of signups. I'm really disappointed in Mark there, Larry, that he didn't break it down to the hour.
Or just mention year. This entire year is going to be so much better than last year before we had anything new on.
Exactly.
Either direction.
But he continued, and he said, the second week of the series has also exceeded our expectations and is a credit to the brilliant and dedicated work of the show's entire creative team and cast. We can't wait for fans to see what comes next for the USS Discovery and its crew. So, we didn't get any real numbers. We just got 200% year over year. I don't really know what that means. It's not a surprise to me. I assumed that Star Trek would bring a big boost to their numbers. But what do you think about it, Larry?
Well, obviously it was going to bring a big boost to the numbers. If it didn't bring a big boost, a lot of heads were going to roll. That was the whole point of bringing on. Remember, a new Star Trek was the first thing they announced. They didn't announce what the show would be, who would be running it at all. Alex Kurtzman was the only name involved. They didn't remember that. Nothing about Prime versus Kelvin. None of that. It was just, hey, we're doing a Star Trek to launch our show big time, because we're going to compete with Netflix and all that gang, and Hulu and Amazon Prime. So if the numbers didn't jack it, what happens here? And to be fair, none of those streaming services ever released their numbers. It's amazing that we're going from the era of Nielsen ratings and numbers for, you know, the networks where they charge ad rates based on those numbers, to the era of if these, you know, HBO, the old school premium channels versus now the streaming services, they're the only ones here in the States with nominees and Emmys. Maybe some of the sitcoms still get some network guys, but all the Emmys are being nominated and won by all these streaming and premium channel people who don't care about ratings, which is part of the formula on Discovery. But we've gone from numbers transparency to no one knows. And that's why that study where Netflix talked about the top 11 episodes, that shocked everybody. Yeah. But the fact that they mentioned how many whatever it was, 1.9 million, that's off the top of my head, I could be wrong. But the fact that they were actually mentioning how many subscribers they had in all 190 countries they were in was kind of like a rare glimpse into how many people they owned up to. So, I didn't expect CBS to say the numbers. So it's, on one hand, it's encouraging and fun, and they're saying this, and they want some PR and some good headlines. But I'm totally not shocked that they're not mentioning real numbers, because they're probably very small. I've seen some stories speculating where they are trying to estimate numbers, and it's still small. But then CBS All Access is new; they're not Netflix, and they're trying to gain. And we read about the people grumbling about the All Access here in the States. Now, you guys and the rest of the world, oh, it's Netflix. Of course I'll watch. It's a whole different ball of wax here where people are griping about having to take a new system and a new system that only has one new show they might like? And do I really want Star Trek and a bunch of reruns? And I don't love the Good Wife spinoff that much. And, you know, Survivor, who cares? But it's obviously spiking. I mean, I finally did. A lot of people are. Probably a lot of people are getting groups and having watch parties and getting together on somebody's, you know, like an NFL game or something, or a college game. And a lot of people, I hate to say it, are probably pirating and renting, which is almost like a badge of honor for Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So no surprise, there's no hard numbers there. The fact that it can double, you know, but somebody said, well, double one is still two. I mean,
amazing how math works.
You know,
like that.
People, yes, talk to politicians and people in PR and corporate, you know, corporate marketing about how you can.
I'll take that one more vote.
Yeah. Fun with numbers. Right. But anyway, it's, you know, of course they want to put that out and say that. What's interesting, are we going to get to the part about the ninth episode or?
Yeah. So before we do that, just, I heard someone mention this elsewhere that it is likely, they feel it's likely, and I don't remember who said this, that CBS may eventually release numbers because of the fact that it is a traditional network and normally you do know the numbers for programming. And so they might do that. But then again, you know, when I think about it and listening to what you're saying here, they might not, because this is a streaming service, so they might treat it differently than they did their previous programming. So we may not find out for sure what these numbers are.
Right. And again, a rational person would stand here with no axe to grind and say, well, of course, these are maybe small numbers, absolute numbers, because they just really began. This is their first 6 months of original programming, of course. But in the great wash of people, you know, stampeding for clickbait and headlines and grabbing, they don't want to lose track of the, you know, oh, look, compared to Netflix, who's been around for 10 years or whatever.
And was a DVD by mail service before that.
Right. But I mean, it's like, look at these tiny numbers. Oh, what a failure. It's like, no. I mean, I don't blame them at all for doing it. It's what they have to do, but they have to be judged on their own merits, not compared to the rest of the universe right now. Cause they're so new. And of course they're thrilled. And yes, if Discovery didn't double their numbers from a year ago or whatever,
we would be really worried, right?
There would be a lot of worry. Although the online American threads and Canadian, I guess too, to some extent, it's so myopic, you know, but the effect that Netflix has provided 3/4 of their revenue for their budget. I mean, we forget that. And people have even speculated and said, what if, not that Discovery fails, but that Discovery fails to deliver the numbers for this new CBS arm, aside from people losing their jobs, would they punish Star Trek and Discovery and this production team because of that expectation and because the rest of the world through Netflix is supporting it and funding it? And would Netflix rise up and say, oh, come on, guys, no, another year, we love this. Netflix has done their own promotional bits, right?
Well, over here, it is a Netflix original series. There's no mention of CBS whatsoever.
Well, of course.
Well, I mean, I've said what you're saying, maybe what I said previously on a different show is a little bit different, but I feel like Netflix could be the safety valve for Discovery, that if CBS All Access were to fail, Netflix would just take over Discovery in conjunction with CBS, but it would just be a Netflix show everywhere.
Right. Or in the States, they could still get something out of it and move it on. This is what we said 10 years ago. John Van Sitters and I said this conversation in the aughts, right after Enterprise went off, that what would happen to the next show, the next series, that it still would not be on network, even though the network bar for success was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. I mean, Enterprise would be such a huge hit now if it was
would be,
today's
actually,
numbers.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But there's always Showtime. There's CBS's, you know, CBS's HBO, the premium service they own is Showtime. It could be on Showtime and still be a moneymaker and still not, you know, and still go 13, 15 episodes and be in the same format and the same look and in the same realm of respect and competition and up for awards and trying to be a franchise, you know.
But you would get the same complaints from people who don't subscribe to Showtime, that they now have to subscribe to Showtime to watch Discovery, and Showtime doesn't have anything else that I want to watch.
That's true. But what I'm saying is if CBS All Access is the, becomes the bigger item here in the equation, even bigger than Star Trek itself, there is that, there's that plan B, there's that back door.
Right.
Or just go to Netflix, as you said, or just go to Netflix. But that would be, I just have to think that the corporate pride of CBS, after having gone down this road, that it had to be pretty dire. It had to be a great PR juggling act here, and letting Netflix take the lead on the, because that was, would have, I'm sure that was the whole point. It's like Gene negotiating with the networks before they decide to have TNG be a syndicated series for its own respect and not to be on the bubble all the time and not to be censored, you know, his whole experience with NBC in the 60s. And it's almost like, what if the network that TNG put together fell apart after a year and they had to go crawling back to Fox or one of the networks, who would then say, ha ha ha, so you came crawling back, eh, Gene? I mean, it's almost like the situation now, if All Access did fail, and of course All Access could still just be a cheapy, you know, rerun basement, you know, to go get CBS stuff if anybody really, really wanted that. But if it really did cause the fall of that, it would be maybe the same thing. You would have Netflix like laughing. Ha, 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 well, you should have just started with us in the beginning. And for your impudence, where, you know, even though they had the other 188 countries in the world with them. So I don't think it'd be vindictive. But yeah, I can just see somebody at CBS going, no. Let's try Showtime before we go. Unless there's math involved here in the financing that I'm not aware
of. Well, that's the thing, right? I think you're right about the corporate pride. But if they had a deal behind the scenes that would be profitable for the studio, and then they can handle the PR juggling that would be required, make it all work out.
The face saving, yes.
Yeah, the face saving part, maybe so.
Well, and Netflix would say, hey, look, we've got all this corporate infrastructure to support it anyway. We just have to tweak our English sounding announcers to sound really American, American Canadian, you know, and not so British. Right.
So, well, let's come back from the speculation about the potential gloom and doom of CBS All Access not succeeding, because right now things are looking positive and the news is that it's looking positive. So we're just thinking, like, what if it didn't work out? We don't want the series itself to be collateral damage. So we're thinking ahead of
And don't quote me on this, but the people that are on staffs, I got to talk to a lot of the writers and production people at the party after party Tuesday before the premiere. And I, at least then, people said that CBS All Access, unless Moonves was there that night. I saw him in the little, one of the little cabanas of the producers. So he was like, he was looked happy. But someone told me that so far that they were happy with the numbers they were getting. So just to put a cherry on top of that for now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. And since things are going well so far, we found out this week that the fall season, the first chapter of Discovery's first season, is being extended. Originally, it was going to be 8 episodes, with the final episode airing on November 5th. Now it's going to be 9 episodes, with the final one airing on November 12th.
Right.
And then the second chapter still starts in January. That's 6 episodes. Refresh my memory, Larry. Was the plan 8 plus 6, or was it 8 plus 7? Like, are we getting an extra episode?
No.
Or
it was 15.
Is one of them's being moved up?
They announced, it was originally announced as 13, and then they went to 15.
Right, and then they
and after they had 15, they announced 7. I mean, I'm sorry. Then after they announced the season debut, they said 8 weeks. So it was going to be 8 and then 7 in the spring. So all they're doing is shifting.
That's what I was thinking, but I couldn't remember for sure. So we're not getting an extra episode. We're
They didn't wake up to decide they should. Right. There's not 16 hours now instead of 15.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Okay.
Right. They've just shifted one forward, which is interesting to me. Is that a natural, the arc of some storytelling? Is there more a natural, what do they call it now? The fall finale. Is there a more natural mini cliffhanger moment after 9? Or does this have to do with the vibe of selling subscriptions and the momentum of sales? You know what I'm saying?
See, I don't think it's that, because everyone who's going to sign up for CBS All Access is probably going to be on board by the 8th episode, I would think. Maybe not.
You wouldn't think that one episode was going to be a difference, right?
Yeah, I don't think that there's a bunch of extra money to be made by giving people one extra week in the fall to sign up, especially when you hear so many people who are saying that they're going to cancel their subscription in November, and then they're going to start it back up in January because they don't want to pay you know, it's sort of like what I do with my ESPN game day package, how I watch college football. I keep it during college football season. I don't pay for it during the rest of the year because I'm not interested in collegiate ice hockey and lacrosse.
When I used to have to buy, right, right. When I used to have to buy CBS's sports audio for my Sooners, it was just audio. It was like the local broadcast.
CBS.
And then two or three years ago, it went away where now I can do it free online, which is amazing. But I would keep it for 3 months and then cancel after.
Yeah. So given that people are going to do that, and I'm sure that CBS is already anticipating that this is going to happen, I think any good business person would. In this situation, I doubt it's that. I think it's more likely that there's something in the story where they need that extra episode in the first half to make the story work. But when I first heard the news, it also made me wonder, in the original plan of episodes, are they inserting some new part of the story that they hadn't planned before? Because as they're writing and filming, they realized that we need to tell this extra little bit, like with Star Trek Beyond, they introduced the whole bit with Kirk meeting the Admiral. You know, that character wasn't in the movie, even when they shot it, and they went back and they did recuts to bring that story element in. Is it something like that where they've needed to add a little bit to the story and extend it one more episode? Or was all of the story planned already, and for some reason they've just decided that we need to tell that ninth part before we go on break? So that the story flows better.
Well, yeah, right, right. It's a more logical break. It's a more logical mini cliffhanger. Yeah. I hope that's what it is. I assume that's what it is. I thought of the financial end of it. I didn't really see. It's like, well, I've been hanging on for 8 episodes wondering, but damn, that ninth one, sign me up. Yeah, I don't.
I'm going to sign up now. I'm going to binge watch the first 9 episodes, and then tomorrow I'm going to cancel.
Right, right.
I'm going to stay up all night, and I'm going to watch everything up to this point. I'm going to call in sick to work tomorrow. I'm going to get up around 2 p.m. I'm going to cancel my All Access subscription. And then, let's see, January, 6 episodes, mid-February, I'm going to do it again.
So what just flashed in my mind is like 10 years from now, or maybe 5, the way the pace of life is picking up. And we're going to have some really old-time fan, like, you know, an Enterpriser. A boomer who will say, yeah, you kids in your 15 episode seasons. In my day, when we binge watched a season, it was a day and 2 hours. It was a Bajoran day we had to do to get all 26 in. You and your wimpy little 15 hour binge watch day. That's nothing. You can get up in the morning and go to bed at night. Yeah. Anyway, I'm just waiting for that day. Mark my words. I said this on October 6th. 2017. You were there.
Okay, so that's the news. CBS All Access doubled their subscriptions, and we're getting a ninth episode in the first half. All right, let's move on and talk about some of the story elements. Another thing in our last episode about Discovery, we had a chapter called Ancient Klingon Secret, and we were speculating on whether these Klingons might be different Klingons than the ones we're accustomed to, and that's why they look different. And now that we've seen the show, we have seen, of course, T'Kuvma and Vok, who could be the albino. And we've seen these other Klingons he's gathered on his ship, and they all have a certain look. And then the 24 houses, they all come to T'Kuvma when he lights the beacon.
Although,
and we see 7 of representatives of 7 of those houses project themselves holographically onto the bridge of his ship. Now, I was reading some comments, and someone made the statement that the writers lied to everyone, like blatantly lied before the premiere to try to get everyone to be quiet about the Klingon controversy by saying that these are different Klingons. And because all the Klingons we saw in the first 2 episodes looked like T'Kuvma or similar, they had some differences, but they all had a new look. That was proof that we've all been lied to.
Right.
But we only saw 7, and there were 24 houses. So there are representatives of 17 houses that we haven't seen yet.
I thought I'd heard someone actually say that there might be a smooth head or a hairy headed one in the background somewhere. And I was, believe me, I was sitting at the premiere in that big theater at the Cinerama Dome scanning those six or seven faces in that Hollow meeting, right? freehollowcall.com. And I didn't see any, but then I suddenly went, wait a minute, they've just made this. Yeah. It's only 7 out of the 24.
It's only 7 out of 17 of 24. Right. And I think that's what a lot of people missed. Not everybody, of course, but some people did. And I was pausing it on Netflix and looking at everyone. And there's this one, and they actually named this character, but I don't remember the name, but the forehead ridges, they kind of protrude out and they almost look like a crown. And at first, until I went and checked over and over, I thought maybe that is inspired by Valkris in The Search for Spock, because we have that woman who's a Klingon who's on the ship and they get the Genesis plans and they destroy the ship. And she's actually wearing a crown. Those aren't forehead ridges. And at first I thought this person was wearing a crown. And then I saw it's forehead ridges.
It's a Klingon tiara. Yeah.
So that was a connection. Yes, that's right. A Klingon tiara. That's a connection that
she
was
actually
not
did
real.
Win the Miss Klingon beauty contest.
Right.
Out of Atlanta. Yeah.
So that wasn't real. But the thing is that with these other 17 houses, it's possible that there are some smooth head Klingons. Maybe there are some people with luscious Klingon Fabio style hair. Who knows?
Cafabio?
Cafabio, yeah.
Cafabio, yeah.
Or Fabio with an apostrophe after
yeah.
the
end. Well, no,
you know,
I
don't
think,
know yet. So
no, we don't. And I was and just because people, you know, I guess there's a limited quantity of how many you can cram into your Hollow viewer. But just
could you imagine if there had been 24 Klingons projected in front of T'Kuvma in that little space?
Wait a minute. It's like the Gideon of Klingon space.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah.
And they're all wearing tights. No, you know what? Here's the funny thing, though. So I'm watching this on the big screen. Everything is unspooling for the first time. Boy, I've been saying unspooling a lot. That's old. That's kind of analog technology. But it's a great verb for reviewers and critiquers. Anybody remember? So when I'm watching it for the very first time, I was like scanning the seven heads, looking, and of course they're holographic-y, so they're kind of fading in and out and they're all fuzzy anyway. And I'm like, but I'm looking at the noses and the way that those two like nostrils on the side of the bridge, like where the Bajoran ridge would be, only on the sides, it's holes, which is different. But anyway, I'm looking and not seeing and not seeing and not seeing. And I started, and I had that first thought, wait, there's only like 7 of them there. 17 aren't here. And then I swear to God, I had Jojo Krakow's voice in my head going, wait a minute, I only saw 7 of them guys in that Hollow meeting. So yeah, that's how bad I am. But it's the point. It's still the point. Yeah.
So there's that point. And just quick take, because I haven't heard your quick take after actually seeing this. How do you feel? I mean, does the new look of these Klingons bother you in any way? Does it take you out of the story?
It doesn't. No, it doesn't take me out of the story. For one thing, they spent 6 months starting with the leak. I went back and found this. Remember the guys, the Instagram from the extra that leaked the big mass picture of Klingon that set the world on fire to begin with? That was February 10th-ish. This year. It's like, wow, it's been 6 months since the great Klingon extra leak. But it's like people have had 6 months to get ready for this. And one of the things after I kind of went at first, my canon smoothing kicked in. And I've said for years about that, you know, they could do it all Klingon series and call it Game of Houses. So yeah. I'm really thrilled to see. I think I said that before. So I don't know if that penetrated Brian and then Aaron and all of them after that, but I'm glad to see that. But that explanation is apparently if that wasn't their initial intention, it's going to be really interesting to go back to the history of the show and see what happened between the pilot writing and then the episodic writing after it. But
yeah,
if that wasn't the original intention, it's what they've embraced and adopted and talked about publicly, like we just said. So 24 houses. I even wonder if the 24 houses was part of the original concept or if that became an added thing. I'm going to be very curious to flesh that out eventually, but in the retconning of things or the smoothing things out. But I've always thought the Klingons were ripe for some diversity, some species diversity. We've been saying that for months. And then finally, I think Aaron Harbutz like leaked, quote unquote, that a few weeks earlier and said, you're going to see Klingons we haven't seen, but he kind of came out with the official line and said, that's what, as we were talking. So no, I was ready for it. I mean, it's very organic. It's very, what's the word I want? Not Baroque, But if you think about it, if you go back and think of how odd the original Sword of Kalis looked on DS9 when they broke into the old Herc, you know, encampment in the Gamma Quadrant and found the stash of Klingon bits.
Yeah.
If you remember how ornate the Sword of Kalis looked compared to your standard clean, chromey looking, you know, Batleth with the you know, leather grips. It's like this is that on a movie budget, on a big budget. But I thought from the beginning and seeing the pieces at the exhibits live at San Diego to Vegas that I could see them being connected to Kalis. And then when they started talking about this is an ancient sect of Klingons, I was thinking there was some, I thought that pod, the esophagus that we have now that wound up being the coffin, I thought it was going to be a Botany Bay canister or something, or a 37s tube or something, a stasis kind of thing. And it wasn't. But it didn't turn out that it didn't have to be literally from the past. They can just be a bunch of traditionalists who are running around, using ancient looking. That's what their house does. That's what their culture of whatever colony world they're from. That's just what they have kept to and have not adhered to the cleaner looking, so all of that's in there. It's all texture. And then I haven't read David Mack's novel. We haven't got to this yet, but there's a lot of retconning going on there. And I'm sure by the time the game people, STO, and all the novelists and all the reference people get finished smoothing off the round edges, things like this will happen. But nothing really took me out of – I was surprised at how slowly they spoke and how much they gave it up to the all-Kling – how much time they spent with the all-Kling online. It didn't annoy me. I was just kind of shocked that they were allowed the freedom to do that.
Yeah.
Because it did make it just seem more alien. They did. The Klingons seem more alien than they've ever done before. I even thought the JJ aliens just looked like, oh, look, it's Klingons. And we put some, I thought it was more funked out with the little head jewelry. It was trying to look like punky like, biker gang.
Like they're all Dennis Rodman fans or something like that.
Right. It was trying to be some no rock statement rather than Klingons.
Right.
So I'm fine with it. I just do want to see a bald head. I mean, I want to see a hairy head and I want to see a smooth head at some point. Even if they're just lurking in the background, I want to see one.
I'm going to trim that little statement right there out, Larry, and we're going to use that as a sound clip on the network now. Just out of context, Larry saying, I want to see a smooth head and I want to see a hairy head.
You had Picard for 15 years. What more do you want? No, I'm
true. Yeah. Now, one thing you've missed, Larry, is that the 24 houses of the Klingons may be the sneakiest ever 47 reference in Star Trek because it is half of 47 plus one.
I did not think of that. And you're absolutely right. So, and they only saw seven. So the last digit of 24 is four. And then with the seven, because you drop the two because it's the first digit.
Yeah, exactly.
Or something.
I mean, duh, right?
Duh, right.
Can't believe no one's talked about this yet.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll just set the tongues a wagon.
So the language, Larry, I did want to ask you about that because it is slow. And I've heard a lot of people comment on how slowly they speak and whether it's being done because they're struggling with the pronunciation of the language or they're struggling with the prosthetic teeth or if it's the type of speech that Takuvma is giving, that's just the way he is speaking. Like you might hear a politician on Earth give some sort of speech where it's very slow and deliberate. Mm-hmm. And it is drawn out. Like for me, it's interesting because I have a degree in language and I studied linguistics and all this in university. And so I think it's interesting when they do use alien languages. But it goes on for so long here that I can see where for a lot of viewers, the pacing might be too slow and you might feel like the story's taking too long to unfold because of it. It's, you know, reading subtitles is one thing, but there is something to be said about the way they've done it in Star Trek in the past, where they've had aliens start speaking in the alien language for a moment and then they switch it to English. And so in your head, the idea is that they're still speaking in an alien language, but so we can be more invested in the story, we're going to switch it over to English.
Well,
how do you feel about the difference in the two?
I was aware of all of that. I mean, my back 10% of my brain was going, wow. It wasn't so much they're talking too slow, I hate it. It was more like self-analytical of, wow, I can't believe they were allowed to do this much that they were allowed to do this much, that there weren't forces bearing down saying, if you go on with this much subtitled Klingon and they're speaking this slowly, we're going to lose half the audience before the second commercial. But it's like there isn't. Well, there's technically a second commercial, but you're paying for it, supposedly. So you're going to watch the whole show. I just kept marveling at how just what a bold, ballsy move it was. I mean, it's, you know, you would not have done that in the old days, but the old days, quote unquote, air quotes, were all on commercial TV. And again, I mean, if you watched, I didn't watch all the episodes of American Gods, but I mean, the pile of American Gods that Brian did, you have to have all kinds of patience. And I think that's a hallmark of a lot of the streaming shows. People are used to being in season, 47 of Game of Thrones now, or whatever the current hit is now going to be next. But people forget about going back, unless you have, some nudity and rapes and things happening to keep people's attention or whatever. But a lot of these shows, they don't care that they start off slowly because they assume that you're watching them on purpose and you're good. It's almost like, that if you turn away now, you're going to miss the next thing. But it's almost like they're snubbing the whole old commercial framework. So right. And they're getting away. It's almost like Gene having all the naked people the first two or three episodes of Next Generation just to snub the fact that he was syndicated and had the freedom. I think this is a little more grounded in the story than the Edo were.
Right.
But I just think there was that element going on. I just think that they're like, no, we're going to make the, not at the risk of saying that the Enterprise finale was going to be a Valentine to fans and having it blow up in their face. But I think having the Klingons be the most alien slice of Klingons you've ever seen and getting them back to, there's some bit to this. There were some comments about, and maybe this was Brian back in the early days of this talking about how the Klingons had almost become honor buffoons or something, and how getting them back to being really as scary as the Borg were at the beginning, really having them, terrorizing and murderous and alien. And that definitely happens here. In fact, let me just say one other thing. What really got me about the whole Klingon look and language and this subtitle bit is when they finally do talk, and they're talking to Georgiou, I think. I don't think with Burn.
Well, and also to the Admiral.
They break out in English.
Yeah.
So, and they're doing that. They're doing that intentionally. I mean, they have translators.
And the English sounds like someone who's not a native English speaker.
Exactly.
Right? So is different than past Star Trek.
What really came across to me, because of that long, laborious buildup of so much Klingon, And at that speed, that when they switched, what it told me was, A, these are not a bunch of country bumpkin Klingons from the hinterlands, that they did have first contact 100 years earlier. They did have English, they had Archer English in the databanks. They could go back and translate. The culture had the information. The sect, this house, these houses had kept up with it, and that T'Kuvma was a charismatic, smart enough, intelligent enough person, entity, that he was a pretty fluent English speaker to turn it on like that.
Right.
And then on top of all that, as he was doing it, I almost got the vibe of he was like condescending. It's like, all right, I'll speak your crappy little backwards, especially when he's going on and about, and it's the political message in the bit, when he's going on and on about your Federation, where humans and Vulcans and Andorians and Tellarites are all living side by side. That's so disgusting, and you've lost the purity of your peoples. And he's bringing that nationalist, message. That's the kind of the political commentary, the us versus them. That's there, and diversity is bad. Forget Edic. But it's almost like by him breaking into English and speaking in her voice, he not only proved his own intelligence and the intelligence of his whole people and his culture, but he was able to bring to me, it was like condescending. It was like, I don't need a translator. I can speak your pathetic, little, pitiful, stupid language. I don't know if that was the intention or not, but it came across to me, and it came across because it worked. It worked. And of course, since he had a whole... It was a little like what Hitler talking to Chamberlain at Munich. It was kind of like or Kirk talking to Khan. Here it comes. I mean, it was like the guy with the plan who was about to unveil, and I'm going to lead you on here the way he did Georgiou before they lowered the hammer.
Yeah. Well, and the Admiral too, because the Admiral, you know, he presented his position to the Admiral, like, okay, yeah, we'll talk. And the Admiral, I've got everything.
Yes.
It's going the way I would expect it to go because I'm the Federation.
And the whole setup of the wait for it, we come in peace was really, that coming, but it was really, even though you knew it was coming, it was great. It was a great moment when it came. So I thought that was set up really well.
Yeah. That's a really interesting point about the language and how it plays into the relationship.
Right.
Yeah, because you think of like Tecuvma and this group as being ancient and disconnected from the Klingon Empire. But like you said, the fact that not only are they aware of Federation standard or English, but he has actually learned to speak it, shows that they are still connected to the current events of the Empire.
And I don't know that, I don't know that that would have hit me had they not had that long, long extended scene of them speaking in Klingon.
Probably not.
And not doing the quickie TV, we've got to switch because we'll lose them before the commercial switch that we just have to in our head go, oh, it's just the storytelling lens.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't suddenly in their own language switch over.
Yeah, it's interesting. The one drawback to it that I noticed, I thought of right away, is that if you're blind and you're a Star Trek fan and you can't read those subtitles, you're lost completely as to what's going on in this story. And we have a number of blind listeners to Trek FM who have asked us, you know, can we get a transcript of what's being said? Because we have no way of knowing. And it depends on where they are, because I know that one of our listeners, Paula in the UK, said that there it's read out to them. So she can still get the subtitles.
I was going
to
say they don't have audio.
But in other, it depends on where you are, I think. In some systems, it's not read out and therefore you wouldn't know. That comes for me from advertising and doing copy for video ads and such.
Right.
The idea of putting text on screen that must be read, especially in television commercials, generally not a good idea if you want to get your message through. But here it's a huge balancing act, right? Because everything you just talked about, which makes it a very interesting story and a different kind of story, the only way you can accomplish that is by doing what they've done. So, you know, you can't satisfy every possible scenario.
Right.
That's interesting. One thing that I've mentioned in social media, and we talked about it on the other side of the room, is the fact that on Netflix, you can actually switch your subtitles into Klingon. And they've actually translated the entire script for every episode in the Klingon, and you can turn it on. And even as the Starfleet officers are talking to each other in English, you can see the Klingon at the bottom of the screen.
I had missed this, and I had my very first European primetime Portal 47 Ask Dr. Trek Roundtable telebriefing last week. And so I had a lot of the Brits and an Austrian and a Swiss member all on, and some Americans, and they brought that up. And I was totally gobsmacked. I did not know that. And the Americans, our American Portales, didn't know either. And we were all like, oh, and we like, where did that come from? Did Netflix pay for that separately? Because if it was a CBS, if it came out of the central production hub, it would have been equally available to everybody, unless CBS said, no, we don't want it, which I can't imagine. If it was paid for, they would certainly take it. So it had to be Netflix.
Although one question I have, and I have no way of knowing this, someone will have to test it. So in the US, typically English and Spanish, right? Does CBS All Access have the ability to carry more than two languages for subtitles?
I don't know. I already have my problems with All Access only because it ain't Survivor. It ain't reruns of I Love Lucy, and it ain't The Good Wife, The Good Life, The Good Fight, because I want to back up all the time, and there's no micro pause. There's no micro fast forward rewind.
Oh, really?
And it popped. I mean, I've already was told when you're watching on a desktop, it keeps wanting to go back and take you back into the menu of all episodes.
Interesting.
If you leave it on pause too long, it wants to jerk you back to the blue screen. It's much better on the tablet. I haven't watched on a phone because I'm not going to like kill myself, but watching on my iPad, it would pause. But you've got one slider bar. There's no control panel for backing up slowly, backing ahead, or even small bits. And it's like, it's hard to get you know, if you get only 2 minutes behind, you just want to see, you just saw something and you just back up to it. I miss my old forehead VCR with the micro pause and record on it. Cause all I want to do is do that. They're missing the boat for the Star Trek audience if they don't at some point bring that into the control interface.
So well, they need to do that for sure. I mean, that's a huge oversight. I wonder if you have Apple TV and you're using the CBS app on Apple TV, if you can tell Siri, you know, go back 30 seconds or what did he say? And it will jump back and turn on the subtitles. That's how Apple TV works. I wonder if that works with CBS All Access app on Apple TV.
I have not brought CBS All Access to our big TV yet because we're in the middle of changing
over. You should try it on Apple TV if you have an Apple TV.
I'm still in the middle of the Apple TV Roku or what decision right now.
Apple TV, Larry, Apple TV.
I know.
What's the debate?
You're talking to the Apple guy from 1988. So, okay. That's not Stardates, that's Gregorian.
Well, let's move on from Klingons and talk about Sarek and Burnham. We had a chapter in our last show called Sarek and Burnham's Vulcan Adventure. And one of my feelings, I've been asked, what do you think about the fact that Burnham grew up on Vulcan and she is Spock's half-sister, or at least adopted half-sister? And until the third episode, we didn't really know if she had actually been adopted by Sarek and Amanda, or if Sarek was just taking care of her. We do find out in the third episode that, yeah, they were her foster parents. And the question has been a bit whether this is a gimmick to tie it into the original series. Like, it's not enough to have a human who was rescued by Vulcans and grew up on Vulcan. We have to tie it in that not only did that happen, but she was part of Spock's family. Like, is that necessary? So that's the first question.
Well, you could make that case. Like, how many other Vulcan parents do we know running around on Vulcan that would give it an emotional tie-in? Now, right. Now, on one hand, there are a lot of people who are incensed when Cybok just popped out of nowhere, right, in 1988. Like, what do you mean? Yeah. Spock's got a half-brother. We never knew about this. And that.
Well, that's why everyone was wearing seatbelts in the movie theater that summer, Larry.
Yes. Yes. Since they disappeared from the bridge of the Enterprise when they were there in the motion picture. Not seatbelts, but seat clamps, lap restraints or whatever. Maybe it's just because I've been through the mill with Cybok. We're talking about this was way before, somewhere between Spock and Sarek being estranged for all those years that we see them get back together in, you know, and people, I don't even remember talking about this with Star Trek V, but the Vulcans have lied so often by omission.
Yeah.
I go back to, you know, like whenever people get all the ultimate thing in Star Trek, when anybody gets their panties in a wad about canon, including me for 5 seconds, I go back and go, guys, the Vulcans told nobody about Ponfar for the record in the Federation database of members for 100 years.
They only told Droxene, Larry. Somehow Droxene knew.
Well, then Enterprise gets back to T'Pol, okay, and that bunch, but still, for the record, outside of the lounge, like late night, you know, coffee hour, whatever, Ractigino, whatever they're drinking, outside of the little personal circle of people that remembered the short, bald-headed orange guys and forgot to get a name, so nobody made a first right. contact report. Okay, in that loosey-goosey,
they're the
time,
Munchkinites, right?
Right. Look, the record keeping of pre-Federation times was not that great. Okay,
yeah, they were not very good. Yeah,
it's like
really sloppy record keeping in pre-Federation times.
Quit finger pointing at the eugenics wars, guys. Quit making fun of the 1990s because apparently the 2150s were just as bad. But
well, Larry, all record keeping prior to the founding of the Federation was done on Wikipedia, right? So it was only about 60% accurate, right?
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to slip in Memory Alpha there, Chris. But okay, no. They just weren't listening to the United Earth podcasts. Whenever somebody gets to the ultimate, you know, downer like that, I say, guys, the Vulcans told the official Federation medical database for physicians, if nothing else, for physicians who had to care for Vulcan patients in crews, You know, it's like, maybe that's why the Intrepid was all Vulcan. Maybe we open up a can of worms there. But it's insane that they had known each other since 2061, that they had been fellow allies in a Federation since 2161, and it takes until 23, you know. Well, no, it's, wait. Yeah, 100 years. It's 100 and something year, 106 years before they, if somebody on the record finds out about Pon Farr, and it has to be Spock, the half-human Vulcan, explaining it to his human doctor, you know?
Right.
So Vulcans and secrets? I got no problem with Vulcans and secrets.
Sure, sure.
If the culture can do that, personally, it's like, oh my God.
But the other component to the question, that's part of it. Like, does it make sense? Is it a problem? And I've said, no, it's not a problem that we didn't know about it. That's, you know, Cybok, Journey to Babel.
Right.
Pon Farr, Spock has a wife, you know, all this stuff. But
Inner eyelids.
But is it necessary? That's the other part of the question. Like, could they have just told this story without having that hook?
Well, it was, I don't know if it was necessary or not, but they, of course, and I don't want to spoil episode 3, and I'd forgotten this, and good on Aaron for pointing it out from Saturday Morning Trek, that the whole dropped line in the animated series about how Amanda was, Spock knew his Lewis Carroll Alice in Wonderland reference.
Right.
And there's and he just drops a little throwaway line about, oh, my mother, you know, they needed it for the story and for Spock to know something, and Spock just generically knowing everything. He knows more Earth references than he knows, you know, Vulcan references, apparently, but he's worth a human crew. And for them to drop that line is as a little throwaway explanation. Oh, my mother was a great fan of Lewis Carroll. Well, for them to come back to, because it works really well here when she's running away and she's in the Jeffries tunnel, and it's up is down and down is up, and trying to get her footing with Lorca, and whoever stumbled upon that as the metaphor they wanted to use, and then they made it physical by her zooming through the Jeffries tunnel and down the chute and all that, made it very Alice-y. And then for that to be the little metaphor that she quotes and thinks of, and then to come back to, and then at the end there, I didn't see it coming. And I didn't get it. I thought they just dropped it in. Oh, and it's how they mention Amanda. But then for Aaron, and kudos on you, Aaron, you got me there. I would have got it eventually when I was scouring the episode, but up front, it was like, oh, now that's not a need. It's not like we have to have, we have to have a Lewis Carroll Alice in Wonderland reference here. What can we do? Well, we were going to invent this Vulcan couple that were her foster parents, but why don't we have it be Spock and Amanda, since Amanda was already on record as being a human, you know? So I don't think that's the deal breaker that said, oh, of course you should have done that. But I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it. Sarek was, apparently there were only 18 actual Vulcans living on Vulcan, and Sarek was a leader. So of course he got all the important foster kids to raise from human parents. Of course they did. No, it's a good dynamic with Amanda being, like you said, it's the reverse of Spock being trying to achieve his father and always having his mother's approval.
Well, that's the next point, right? So,
yeah.
And before we get to that, I've come around a little bit in my thinking on it, because my initial thinking was that this is an unnecessary gimmick, that you could have just had a human who grew up on Vulcan and she's struggling with logic and emotion, and you tell a story that way, and you're trying too hard to connect it with the original series by making her part of Spock's family.
You're pandering, you're fan servicing,
But at the same time, there weren't a lot of humans on Vulcan that we know of. And the fact that Amanda, being a human, was there, it does make sense that if the Vulcans rescue a human child after this Klingon attack, that they would take that child to Sarek and Amanda, because Amanda is a human. That does make sense. So I'm coming around a little bit on that and thinking that, okay, well, yeah, I guess, yes, it does give you that connection that you feel is necessary that might not be, but logically it does make sense.
And back to the beginning, now this is what hit me. The minute I saw the casting news, they're going to have Amanda as an actual living character on the show. They've cast the
actress. And one fan on Twitter tweeted to us that that was the final nail in the coffin, that they would not have anything to do with Discovery anymore at all because they're bringing Amanda on the show.
Can I just say, when Brian was first announced, this is what I
know, it was one of the first things they said.
One of the first things, when people were scrambling for crumbs, people were crying for any details. When the fact that Brian said, We'll have robots at that very first Comic-Con press conference. And people were like cringing. They were like scraping, begging for crumbs. And he was dropping that and maybe the first interview he actually gave. Day one, Brian said, you know, I've always loved Amanda as a character. Well, why would he say that if he wasn't? Then when they announced James Frame playing Sarek, I was like, did they just decide to flip it and have it be Sarek and not Amanda?
Yeah, he pulled the old switcheroo on us. I love Amanda, so I'm going to bring her husband on the show.
Right. So the fact that she mentioned her and the Lewis Carroll Alice connection there.
Yeah.
I was, that's interesting. Okay, so they're still lingering around with Amanda. And then when they announced that they'd cast a living actress to play a living character, I was like, see? One more thing before we leave this. Has anybody realized that the whole Burnham parents being killed, she's orphaned and raised by Vulcans, is almost like a riff on Worf at Kittimer having his parents killed and being raised by the Rozhenkos?
Yep.
I don't know if there's like going to be an ulterior, you know, ultimate payoff to that, but it's at least a meme and a trope that we've had before. I don't think I've seen anybody complaining about it. I don't care, but I'm just throwing it out there.
I don't think I've noticed anyone even mentioning that, but the payoff, of course, is going to be in episode 15 when Michael Dorn guest stars on Discovery.
As her long-lost human adult brother.
Yes.
Who has an alien girlfriend who needs to be moved secretly with her whole colony world. And no, I'm kidding.
Larry, I tell you what, CBS is going to come down on us. All of these plot points that you are leaking today.
I know.
Don't tell anybody. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the Vulcan angle, because I was thinking about the fact that Burnham represents a fourth way of approaching logic versus emotion, which is what has always been done with Vulcans in Star Trek. In the original, we had Spock, who is half Vulcan, half human, raised on Vulcan with a human mother, went through the Science Academy. We see him struggle with logic and emotion throughout his time on the original series and through the movies. And we see it get reset after he dies. And then he comes back at the beginning of Star Trek IV. He's retraining his mind. And he's trying to really, for a while, he is purely Vulcan. And then he gets the emotional side back.
He's trying to be the most uber of all Vulcans. And his dad is even going, relax every once in a while. And he's, and does a Kulinar.
So then on Voyager, we have Tuvok, who is full Vulcan. And even though he serves with humans on Voyager, he remains really fully Vulcan all the way through. Then in Enterprise, we have T'Pol, who is full Vulcan, but is a bit different from other Vulcans and spends all her time with a fully human crew, almost fully human. You know, her and Phlox are the two aliens on the ship, which is why they have lunch together all the time. And we see how that environment affects her.
Right. And having been at the embassy on Earth even before she was in the crew. I mean, she'd been around humans even before that. Right.
Exactly. So then we see how that environment of being around humans affects her. And now we have a fourth way of looking at it, which is a full human.
That's what you mean. Yeah.
Who grows up on Vulcan, goes to the Vulcan Science Academy, then is brought by Sarek to be with humans on the Xinjiang. And she's trying to come to grips with the emotional side. I mean, she has been growing up, but she stepped out of that fully Vulcan environment as an adult. And we're seeing the struggle from yet a fourth angle. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. It's like parsing it that way, but that's interesting. But you go back and for some reason, I've seen episode 3 now way more than I saw the first two. But going back to her whole conflict, because I was really troubled at the beginning of the pilot. Coming out of the Voyager pilot, I really thought that it was just a false choice for drama. I really did not enjoy Janeway blowing up the array over the Prime Directive. It's like, you've already interfered. You've already done this.
Right.
How is interfering in one direction? If you're going to interfere in the Prime Directive, save your ship and your crew and go back through. Blow it up from within. You're like, all these things. It's the same thing I thought when the Enterprise went down in Star Trek 3 and they just self-destruct and there's no tricky last-minute save and there's no little, you know, MacGuffin thing out of a box to fix it. And McCoy and Kirk are just standing there. My God, Bones, what have I done? You've done what you always had to do. Turn it back. It's like, no, you've always saved it before. You Effers just did that for a movie drama.
That is one of my favorite scenes and one of my favorite lines in all of Star Trek.
Okay, okay. But when I was a kid watching that movie, I was like, no, no, you just wanted to have a big movie ending, blah, blah, blah. He could have, you could have written it. You're just a, it's just a frigging movie script and you could have written it any way you wanted to. And you made this choice just because it's a movie and has to be big.
But that's how I did feel about Generations, Larry, when they destroyed the D.
That's true. Yes, totally true. Because they fell in love with Rick Sternbach's saucer landing picture, and they'd wanted to do that ever since the sixth season. I feel like we're doing a greatest hits of Ready Rooms episodes past here. But my point was going to be about how they, it's about choices that were made that didn't have to be made. I was trying to get around to talking about how her Vulcan training made her so... even though she'd been out among humans, she'd been back with her crew that totally trusted her. She made this split decision to bring her old Vulcan training and her advice from Sarek directly, however that was arranged, that advice that she just could not unclench from after, even after 7 years of being a totally sane officer and a first officer. Then when she was smacked down, because she was right. She made the right, she had the right call just at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. She had the right call, what they should have done to the Klingons, but the by the book Federation thinking protocol didn't allow it. And, you know, Georgiou was right to say that because it seems shocking. So after the battle, after she's smacked down, after she's court-martialed, it strikes me now thinking it was interesting what they did with her bowl haircut when she was young and then, you know, first coming aboard and all this. But it strikes me that if she had been in prison for 6 months and she'd been a first officer, been stripped of rank, and if she clings to her Federation ideals as strongly as she keeps saying, which I have no doubt, that what was it that saved her sanity through those 6 months? I'm sure it was her Vulcan, you know, her Vulcan mental toughness and her Vulcan mental routines and her Vulcan mental exercises that kept her in her serenity, kept her in her good spot. And she is so quiet when she's with the, she's retreated into that for her own sanity and her own survival. And when she's on the shuttle with the riffraff, and then she comes aboard and she's being jerked around. And I want to say retroactively, she's being tested. I even wonder if Landry is even that rough around the edges with language. If that wasn't some kind of a setup to test Burnham the minute she came aboard, because Lorca is so,
I hope
Lorca is so spinningly, you know, conspiratorial that if all this wasn't, you know, he's not exactly the cigarette smoking man, but if this was the X-Files of Star Trek here, but that whole time she is so into her Vulcan head, but that's her survival mode. That's like Spock in Private Little War almost, you know, it's not, she doesn't need Chapel to come in and slap her awake. She's not that deep. But the meditative quasi-trance that she's put herself into to survive prison and survive this insanity, when she knew she was right, if they had done what she wanted, they wouldn't have lost 8,000 people. Even though she can realize now maybe my methods weren't the right, but my point was correct. And I haven't heard people talking about, has the world at large talked about how Burnham was right all along?
I mean,
do you think so?
You know, it's an interesting question. That's where I think this series is, the way Deep Space Nine did sometimes, it's challenging the viewer to figure out what's right and wrong. She was right in terms of her analysis of the situation. The question is, as an officer, was she right in trying to take the action over the wishes of her captain? And
she thought she was looking out for the good of the many to outweigh the good of the few or the one.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's where the Vulcan part comes in, right? Mm-hmm. She was more concerned. She tells Georgiou, I'm trying to save you. I'm trying to save you all. She knew there would be repercussions for her, but her Vulcan nature of the needs of the many outweigh the need of the one took over. And she felt that to save not only her ship and her crewmates, but the entire Federation from a potential war, the best thing to do.
And
was,
even Klingons.
Yeah.
And even
and to save the Klingons from the war too. Like, let's not have
from
this
themselves.
Conflict.
Right.
She knew from the Vulcan interactions with Klingons that what you have to do is put your foot down from the start and then you can avoid everything else. But that's a separate question from should she have taken those actions as the first officer of the ship, as a Starfleet officer. Most of the reactions that I have read have been that she was wrong to take the action because, as a Starfleet officer, she should not be going over the head of her captain in that way.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer. It depends on who you are and how you're looking at the situation.
Well, it strikes me that basically the good of the many outweighs the good of the few of the one phrase is basically big picture thinking. And the Vulcans, mm-hmm. I guess, are the big picture civilization at times. I think sometimes the humans get there because obviously it was the humans that brought everybody together in the first place. The Vulcans and Andorians hadn't been able to get out of it. The Vulcans aren't the end all be all of the cool kids. But yeah, and that's a case where the big picture, her DNA or her adopted DNA kicked in and she just couldn't shake it and she was caught up
in the
moment.
Well, you could also say her culture kicked in because at this point...
That's what I mean, yeah.
You know, 7 years on this ship with Georgiou is fine, but that's not really enough time to overcome the culture that you were brought up in. Now, you can live in a foreign culture for a really long time and really start to be like that culture and less like your own. But the culture you're raised in never fully leaves you.
Especially when you began your life in that culture in trauma.
Well, exactly. If you were the trauma in mm-hmm. particular. But even if there were no trauma.
Right. That trauma even more so.
Is so critical. So what I hear when you talk about this, going back to my original question, is that part of the point of Spock's journey through Star Trek was Spock learning to take humanity and work that into how he saw the world to help him along with how he lived his life and interacted with others.
Right.
And this is the flip where
instead of running away from it, finding the best of both worlds as finding the best way to merge. Right.
You know, but Kirk's always encouraging Spock to be more human or to, you know, take in. And we saw that on The Next Generation where Data was always trying to do that. But if we keep it with the Vulcans here, Burnham has been becoming more human during her time on this ship. But when this situation arose, mm-hmm. like you said, her culture, her background kicked in and became fully Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
So she's embracing the Vulcan aspects, whereas on the flip side with Spock, we see him trying to embrace the human aspects.
She just sensed the stakes.
Much of his time in Star Trek.
As writers and actors like to talk about the stakes. If they'd just been running around cataloging gaseous anomalies for 7 years or whatever, this is the biggest, you know, crisis to hit them in a generation and a species that they thought had just kind of retreated back into the corners of the galaxy. Then she's on. She had her own. What was it? The fear ganglia.
Saru has. Yeah.
If she has her own Vulcan fear ganglia, you know, and then Ferengi's lobes tingle. But if she had that kick in like it had never done before, or had not done since she'd worn a Starfleet uniform, or in ages, or the first time since she was in the attack that her parents were killed in. Of course, that's part of the thing: is are you going back to the trauma? Are you acting on your trauma trigger?
Well, it would naturally be triggered in her in the situation.
Right. Anyway, that was interesting. It's a lot of things to pull into there. But my bottom line was she had the right strategy. She was just not going to be able to get through the miniature Starfleet bureaucracy in front of her, the captain and the first officer the second officer that she had to deal with at the moment. And it's neck pinching your captain is not the best way to win your argument. But
But it's not Saru who stops her. It's Georgiou waking up. So the neck pinch wasn't strong enough, right? She didn't do a good enough job there. Otherwise, they would have fired on the Klingons, and who knows, the story would have been different.
Saved a war.
Okay, let's move on to another point. We've kind of touched on things here and there throughout our discussion where we see a lot of nods to the original series and the animated series and the literary universe, and also modern Trek with TNG onward, things like the site-to-site transport, which made a bunch of people upset because technologically they're not supposed to be able to do that yet, which always just leaves me scratching my head, like going, really, this little detail? Like,
time? They make a big deal out of site-to-site transport with Kirk 10 years later, but all they say is that it is tricky. They don't say they can't do it, correct?
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. They just say it's tricky.
And think about it. Do you want them in this episode of Discovery to walk out of the ready room and walk all the way down to that part of engineering, take the time to do that, or just have them beam down there and get on with the story?
Well, it's driven by the story, and I'm trying to remember where that happens, but it was a tense part of the story when they did that. No, look, they could have just said beam us over and screwed that. But the fact that they took the time to say initiate a site-to-site transport.
Yeah.
The only thing more they could have done was to have the other person at the other end of the line, I forget who, if it was a character or just a voiceover, say, Captain, are you sure you want to do that? Or whoever it was. Are you sure you want to do that? You know,
the computer could have said,
yes,
Captain, this has never been done before. Are you sure you want to do this? And yeah, warning, you are about to violate canon.
Yes.
Are you sure you want to do this?
It could have been operating protocols, but yes. I would have been more upset about the constant talking computer, but anyway.
True.
No, the site, I was thrilled that they took the time to say site to site transport.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how it hit me.
My question here, and in my contribution to The Edge, which is our Star Trek Discovery podcast here on the network, is I do a sub-show called Notes from the Edge. And on that show, I look for connections between Discovery and the broader Star Trek franchise and universe. And in particular, I look for connections to the literary universe because I'm finding, and maybe it's because Kirsten Beyer is on the staff, they're finding lots more connections to the literature and they're working those into the story. The Black Fleet is a really big one. My first episode of Notes from the Edge, I go into great detail about the Black Fleet, where it was used in literature, and the fact that if you translate the song that they sing in Soldiers of the Empire on Deep Space Nine,
I was going to say that's.
They mentioned the Black Fleet.
Now, I knew that reference. Because that's aired. I gave up. I've admitted this. I love all the authors. They're all good friends of mine. And I try to keep up as the stream has flown by. But years ago, I had to give up in the old universe, in the old landscape of Trek, because it was just polluting my mind too much. We had two shows going at the same time.
Yeah, it's hard to keep it straight, right, when you start talking about
it. Yeah, well, I didn't want to pick up literary and then have it be confused with aired canon. And now we have, you know, we have Wikibeta and a lot of things to do that. But what jumped, I mean, I don't want you to repeat, but like, what's the main, was Black Fleet the main thing that jumped out at you? I'd forgot. Was that in John Ford's? I know they've used John Ford's Final Reflection.
It's from the Final Reflection, but it's used over and over in quite a few novels.
Right, it got picked up later on.
Video game, right. DS9, the song they sing in Klingon.
The origin point was Final Reflection, yeah.
Yeah. Final Reflection is the origin. And it was used in the faster role-playing games as well. So the point, though, the question I want to ask you is that with all of these connections between the animated series and the literary universe, and we might need to separate the two, coming into Discovery, now Discovery is very clearly canon. It's a CBS-produced television series. Do you think this will change the fan debate? Maybe not today, but let's say 10 years later when we look back. Is this going to change the fan debate over whether the literary universe is canon or elements of it are canon or whether the animated series is canon? I think some people forget, well, they don't know that I believe it's the entropy effect where we get, that's where the name Nyota Uhura comes from and Hikaru Sulu comes from. They didn't have first names in the original series.
Right.
Their names came from the literature and were then used in the movies after that. So we have elements. We've always had elements that have come from.
Well, and Nyota was never even used until the first JJ movie.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Right.
So we've always had these elements that have been picked up and brought in that we accept as canon because they were on TV or in a movie, but they originated in the literary universe. So how do you think this might change the discussion or the debate?
Well, I would separate them. Number one, for one thing, original series, the animated series, TAS, not to be confused with the old Soviet press agency.
thanks for clearing that up, Larry. We had a lot of confused listeners.
There's enough mud out there clouding the airwaves that we don't need this. I remember at first blush, I remember animated series was canon because we our first go round with trying to do a timeline, the first, when Jeff Mandel was first doing his nonfiction zine, and we were the timeline that made sense, the Kzinti. And part of the reason, one of the biggest stumbling blocks against the animated series, I think both legally, because no one in the 70s ever thought about this lasting so long, or about estates and Niven's, you know, estate versus Paramount and the overlapping mm-hmm. bit there from was it Known Space was a series, the Kzinti. In the Kzinti universe, Kzinti were the first aliens that humans made first contact with, and there was a war. And so the original timelines that fans were, that the background fandom, all, you know, four or five or six or seven of them, of us eventually, by postal mail, were trying to merge the animated series in. So the Bonaventure was the first warp drive ship. And the other big stick was that the Kzinti were the first aliens humans encountered, you know, before Vulcans, before everything, because that's what the Kzinti side of Niven's universe had been. And the Kzinti War and trying to merge all that. And it was nobody, I don't think people thought about like pulling out pieces of the animated series. And only, there are parts I thought were cheesy, like the force field belts are obviously a cheap way to animate without drawing a complicated environmental suit. Okay, I get that. I was kind of going at the time for the technology level of the time. But it was always canon to me at first. And then Gene decanonized animated. He did. In the 80s, 90s, all through the original run of the shows. And then basically they got recanonized when somebody, I don't want to be cheesy about it, but I think when somebody said, hey, we could be selling these for, we could remaster these on Blu-rays and sell them, they became canon again. Now, backing up, there were beloved episodes, you know, Yesteryear is the shining example, and Dorothy wrote it. So we'll pulling out elements of the animated series and then, you know, the canon is what is aired. Now, there are conflicting bits, and then we have to go to the level of, you know, resolving the aired canon discrepancies. But aired canon is what you go with. And if there's evolving aired canon, like from USPA into the UFP, then you either ignore it or you just say they're evolving, or you get really creative as the years pile up and you come up with, well, USPA was the Earth agency, and then it was still around in some way, and Kirk still referred to it even in the Starfleet era. Okay. Whatever. But there's an evolution to canon that we're just human beings doing a TV production. That's just what's going to happen. So shut up and find the canon retcon. Find the gap fill. Find the canon smoothing that's going to make it work. So the other end of this is that the originals, the animated series has had this political, it's canon, now it's not, now it's canon. In the next 50 years, it might be in and out and in and out. Again, who knows? I think the more time goes by, the more it'll settle in. And it seems to be pretty much there now. But that's one level. What fans do in their own, if that does happen, and it's out of canon fashion, and now it's back into canon fashion, fans are still going to have their head canon, which mm-hmm. was a thing that always existed. And it's only been like, you know, world building or cinematic universe is a term that got invented finally, but people in Star Trek were carrying it around 20 years ago and didn't know it had a special term. But I think people are going to have their own head, just like everybody carried their head canon of, you know what, whatever you think of Dr. Caniclius and the giant Spock, or whatever you think of the force field belts or the Kzinti, people inherently loved Yesteryear, and it felt right, and it felt there. And oh, look, Dorothy wrote it herself. And look, they got Mark Leonard to voice Spock. So everything about it just felt right. And so people, you know, Mike and Denise used it in their background references. And then finally, the writers, especially Enterprise, went back and used that. But even beyond the original series, I mean, the animated series, I think, is a thing apart. I don't know. Who's arguing that it's not canon now? I have no use for them. I mean, everybody, it's America. You can go off and think what you want to think. But in the major discussion, I don't know why that's a thing. Now, same token, only flip. Literature cannot be canon because it's there. It's had a lot of different regimes running the publications over the year, doing the editing, doing the direction. There were a lot of loosey-goosey things in the early days. Ishmael's Son got published before anybody realized it was a glorified fan novel story that was cute, using all the guest stars from Trek who were in Here Come the Brides. And they totally told Here Come the Brides and no one caught it. You know the story, right? They had to go back and pay Screen Gems, Columbia, all this money because they'd used, you know, Mark Leonard's character on Here Come the the Brides was Aaron Stemple, and they used the Bolt brothers and the whole thing of the Seattle women being brought to, I mean, the Massachusetts women being brought to Seattle in the lumberjack days, which was a real historical thing. It's just funny that this novel came out and I was like, oh, this is cool. They've used Here Come the Brides with the tie over because of all the guest stars. But What of Lazarus? Michael Brown was the lead in Here Come the Brides. And David Soul. They had three Star Trek guest stars on this show. Anyway, my point is that the pendulum has swung on what's... It's hard to call all of literature canon. And they've even made the attempts to unify it. A few years ago, they had the unified concordance of all the fiction up till that time. And now, the regime has been so awesome the last 10, 15 years with Paula Block in, and Paula Block even as a consultant, and what Pocketbooks has done, and what Kevin and Dayton and David and Keith and all of that. And I'm going to get shot because I've left some of them out.
Yeah, Kirsten and Una and everybody. Yeah.
Right, and they get together and they've really made it something. In 15 or 20 years, will that still be the case? I don't know. I hope so. I hope we've got to a permanent level of awesomeness here with the interconnectedness of the fiction, how they've planned everything out. But and it's at a different level than it was before. So, but with still the nature of, and then with Kirsten on staff, we have this announced whole new level. And we've seen that with Desperate Hours, with David Mack's first novel. We have seen, even to the point where keeping him in the loop, not just writing a novel for a TV series with their deadlines they have to go under for script writing, it was a series being hashed out. It was a series being hashed out in flux as this incredible melodrama soap opera of a launching period was happening, and things were coming in and out and being switched around and driving everybody crazy. And here's a poor novelist who could have been totally left out in the cold, but they brought him in. But it was like, what was worse, being left out in the cold or being brought into this chaos of creation, which did finally calm down. And David was even able to put some feedback in. And also, if you read the novel, you know, smooth some corners, like he talks about the uniform canon issue. And after talking to David at Vegas and told me what was coming down the line or hints at what was coming down the line, I felt even better about some of my initial, even my little fanboy glitches about a couple of things and, you know, regrets. Like, just hang in there, that it was all part of the mix. And knowing that, you know, Kirsten is obviously not the executive producer showrunner, but she is in the room and those things are being heard and talked about. So we're at a level where the Discovery books are going to be as close, not just close to canon, but being in the mix. But, you know, it's still TV and they're going to have episodes air after the writers are on hiatus. This is the first, I talked about this with Ted already. It's weird to have them all about to take their hiatus and have 90% of the show hasn't aired yet, right? As opposed to the old days when the writers took their hiatus as all but the last two or three shows were coming off the line.
Right.
So there's a little bit of that, just as far as the needs of publishing and the needs of the aired episodes. And we're not locked into a fall debut. You air from September to May and you shoot from June to March and then you will take 3 months off and everything will start over again. Who knows if there will be a second season, although people are optimistic about it, and B, will it be on the same schedule? Will it debut? And I mean, will it just be at a year later? Will it be on a year and a half later? No one knows. And meanwhile, the books are going to keep going. So you'll eventually get to the point where people are writing books in a vacuum ahead of time. Will the staff change in makeup and mix? We don't know about all these things. So Lit's just going to have to go. Animated series is a contained box from 1974. That's easy to deal with. The literature at right now is at a point it's never been before. I don't know. I'm trying to throw all these things out there to let people realize there's so much. They're not the same. There's so much in play. It's at an awesome point right now. It hasn't always been there. It may not, sadly, stay there. But for right now, let's do all we can to keep it there.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. And for me, at least to start here, like with Desperate Hours, these books will be canon for me, just in the same way that I consider Mosaic to be canon because Jerry Taylor wrote it and it's all about Janeway and she created the character. So it's a book, but I mean, it all came from Jerry Taylor's head. So
I was going to mention Janeway. That. And yes, absolutely. And the way that Gene did the novelization, the motion picture. Mm-hmm. But sadly, when Jerry had retired and was no longer in the writer's room, they came away, they changed B'Elanna's mother's name. I mean, you know, there were things that got changed because Jerry wasn't there. And I think someone in the room would say, because I know licensing made up a list of all the points from Jerry's two novels, Mosaic and the other one.
Pathways.
Yeah, Pathways. There was a list of all the story points to use for overseeing novels and whatever needs. And the writing room had this. And there were specific times when they would change something and say, well, we're going to do this because we need to do this, or this has happened. You know, so it's like, it's not a guarantee, sadly.
Yeah.
It's human beings in a creative mix. And that's what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see where it goes, but I find it interesting how the lines are being blurred a little bit with this series. And we're seeing this stuff come in that we wouldn't have necessarily seen in the past because.
Oh, it's a whole new game. Yes. I'm not trying to down anything. It's at a level it's never, ever, ever been before. And I hope it continues. And it's the same way with the comics. And I hear that Star Trek Online is going to be doing a Discovery element. And I'm sure that, and STO has been so great about their own internal continuity and in a vacuum of no new production happening with old pieces of Trek. So I have a feeling we're going to see the biggest level of coordination ever across all platforms.
And speaking of Star Trek Online, CBS considers the Enterprise F to be canon because they sanctioned the contest to design it. And it was designed for Star Trek Online. So, you know, what makes something canon and what doesn't is interesting. Okay, well, we are at about an hour and a half here, and we want to cover a few more points. So let's move on to our big questions. And this first one, I don't want to talk about very much right now, but it has been pointed out by quite a few people. And I think most of us, especially Niners, had this feeling watching Context Is for Kings. Could the USS Discovery be a Section 31 ship, because the registry number is 1031, which would be kind of clever, but also kind of obvious, and it's probably just a coincidence. The behavior of Lorca feels kind of like Section 31. I don't get the impression that everyone on the ship is part of Section 31. I don't get the impression that Saru is part of Section 31, but maybe Lorca could be. I don't know. I mean, what do you think about the possibilities of Section 31 being worked into this?
Well, again, my whole take on the Section 31 bit is all those things do feel right. And the whole why call out the riffraff walking down the hall says, oh, look, I've never seen a black badge before. And they did the close-up insert of the black badge. Yeah. You don't see the face. You don't see what character's wearing it, but you just see that it's on someone with one of the black field jackets on.
Yeah.
Why call that out if that doesn't mean something? So it might not be Section 31. It might be the Manhattan Project for this pod thing only. Yeah. But here, my main point is what guides me on this is at day one, Brian was asked point blank, will we see people shot three or four things at him. Questions about the show when they were being very tight-lipped on the very first day they were announcing bare details. The big reveal was it was going to be Prime. And then a few more things got pulled out and somebody asked him three or four things rat-a-tat. And one of them was Section 31. And he said, no. Now that was about 47,000 years ago. It feels like in Stardate times, Brian is no longer running the show. It's his basic original blueprint. Has something been altered since then? I don't know. But again, is this something else? There was even somebody forwarded to me a clip, the pullback of Lorca in his menagerie window. Yeah. By the way, they're doing all these Voyager things right now, which are very cool. They're showing you where all the rooms are. There were at least two of them. They're pulling back and it's like, okay, are you going to keep it there? It's like, okay, canon folks, write down. The menagerie is down here under this thing.
Yeah, that was a weird location for the room for sure.
The engineering test bay, when they pulled up the Jeffries tube and out, it's on the starboard side of the spine, you know, coming down from the dorsal. Anyway, close to it. But when they pull back on that, someone sent me a frame and there's a window pattern, you know, the skinny oval windows, like ding, ding, ding. Yeah. There's a window pattern of three and a space and a one. And someone said, do you think this is a clue? And I was like, I don't know. And I actually sent that to John Eaves and I said, okay, is this, I just said, just read this. I just like did a screen grab of the whole question. And he just laughed. He was like, some people will see it in anything. So, yeah.
Well, this would be like the villain or the killer who wants to get caught. And so they leave these little clues everywhere. Like the designers of Discovery are like, we're a Section 31 ship. Why don't we make a couple of windows on the bottom back corner of the ship look like a 3-1?
I even saw a thread. A lot of people I think I knew were in it, but there was a whole thread about it's so insane to think if Section 31 is so, you know, deep state that that why would they have their own patches and uniforms? That's totally antithetical to, you know, totally counterintuitive to them trying to be secretive, unless that's exactly what they want you to think, you know. And then they laughed, and they show Sloan and his guys in DS9, and they're all wearing those token black outfits, like, oh, it's just the token black villain thing, and until it's not. And then they show what's his face, the character from Enterprise that was trying to recruit Reed, wearing the 200 years earlier black version of the Section 31 standard uniform or whatever. No, I really hope it's not. It just it's so overwhelmingly in your face.
But that's the thing. Like, it's too in your face. So my feeling is that I won't be surprised if we find out that there is a Section 31 element going on, because this is kind of the thing they would do, where they feel like we have to do something that can't be sanctioned by the Federation for the good of the Federation. And so maybe Lorca's in on it somehow. But I don't think that this is a Section 31 ship. And I don't think the series isn't going to be about Section 31. The black badges, I think, tie into the same reason it's called Black Alert when they use the spore drive, because that's just the label that's been given somehow to black. And so they have people, black badges.
Yeah. Like people. Yeah. Now, even though Stamets has a regular science badge insignia.
Yeah. The people who have the black ones seem to be some kind of guards. Like, and that's where maybe the Section 31 element could play in a little bit. Like, there are a few people who are in the know on that, but overall, the people on the ship, like Stamets, I don't get any impression at all that he, if there is a Section 31.
He was Mr. Science Guy. He got sucked up into this. His friend's been, his old college buddy, co-researcher has been killed now. He feels partly guilty for it. And he's just into his science. He just resents this. He's the Oppenheimer with the Manhattan Project here.
Right.
That's been pulled in.
Yeah, he resents that his research has been hijacked for military purposes. Sure.
Right. It hit me, I was talking to somebody about, there's also a little bit of, with Stamets, there's a little bit of a David Marcus Genesis project going on here.
Yeah, I can see that.
We've always been the pawns of the military. And that was 100, may I say, canon folk, that was 100 years later. So, and he was a young buck. So and the fact that this is that earlier time with, you know, Doc Carners and perfect people. Not so perfect, still dark.
And speaking of connections to other characters with Lorca, the first character I thought of was Captain Mackenzie Calhoun from Peter David's Excalibur novels. Because Lorca has this damaged eye, right? Mackenzie has this battle scar. And they're both this kind of different kind of captain, kind of rough battle tested, you know. Saru says Lorca doesn't fear the things that normal people fear and so forth. So that's just a small connection. So let's talk about one other point, spore drive, which we just talked about a little bit. It's like the Manhattan Project of this show. The very first thing that I thought of when Burnham went in the chamber and Lorca activated it and she started seeing all these different locations, which, by the way, were a lot of, it's kind of like the greatest hits of backgrounds from the original series that she goes through. But the first thing I thought of was that they're trying to develop the same technology as the Iconian gateways.
That's exactly what I thought. If you can zip somewhere in a second or two and then zip back.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we think about the doorways as being actual portals you walk through, the way we saw them on Next Gen and then DS9. And yes, they were on DS9. Apparently people forget that we're talking about the propulsion for the whole ship. But I think somewhere in the cosmic, you know, kismet of all of this, they would be one and the same. And the Iconians were ancients. They were thousands of years prior to all this.
Right.
But if they're, whatever the sub, you know, Stamets' little wonky philosophy speech about biology and physics being the same thing, if the Iconians stumbled across that early on and found whatever ingredient worked for them in that time period, and this, if it's coming out of the same basic concept on that quantum level. But yeah, I absolutely thought the Iconians, because then I immediately, I think I've talked about this earlier in the week on some, either my own. Yes, I think I brought it up on my own at Tuesday Live, but I didn't know. I tried to madly research to see if STO has fleshed it out, if who has done, or if the books have done that. And I didn't see anything right books. Off.
Yeah.
The actual technology involved.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's, it's a key part of, in the DS9 relaunch.
Yes.
There's a short story called Horn and Ivory, which Matthew and I have discussed on Literary Treks a long time ago.
Well, enlighten me.
And the Iconian gateway technology is one of the, it's how Kira ends up on Bajor back prior, it's kind of ancient times on Bajor. And that is facilitated by this technology, which in this situation, you can use it for time travel as well as location travel.
Okay. But do they actually say what are the nuts and bolts of what makes it go?
Oh, the nuts and bolts, not so much.
That's what I'm saying.
Quite similar, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. And the fact that it could be, you know, bioneural gel packs. I mean, it could be it could be some kind of organic, you know, crossover.
Right. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. And, if that has not been spelled out by anybody or tried to
be spelled. And some people might say, well, you know, like the person who tweeted to us when Lorca had the tribble on his desk and said, no one had ever even heard of a tribble in the original series.
That's not
true. Up until the trouble with tribbles. And I thought, well, the people on the Enterprise hadn't heard of it, but Serrano Jones obviously had because he's selling them. So, you know, they've been around.
Right. And did he,
and the Klingons had because
yes,
they had had to go exterminate them. So, sure. But people might say, well, they didn't discover the Iconian gateways until the Next Generation and Contagion. And so how could they possibly know? But this could be just independent discovery of a similar technology.
Right.
Or it could be that some Federation ship encountered one of these Iconian gateways. And now they're trying to figure out how to do that themselves. And they're finding a different path, technological path, to get the same result.
Well, or if it was an accidental discovery. If, I mean, Stamets and Strahl.
Which is more likely, right?
Yeah, which was actually, that was the name of my first law firm. if they just went down this path, like what inspired them to go into this field of research? Did they stumble into it? Did they see somebody from before them that they wanted to continue their research?
Well, according to Stamets, Larry, it was awe. That's what got him in. That was the weirdest line. I'm like, okay.
Oh, shucks. Yeah. Well, I hope that wasn't the first day that Michael had to shoot. I hope he had some days to work into it. But my point is, we're just drawing comparisons. We're not saying literally it's the Iconian technology. It's like literally this, literally that. But it's in that flow, that spectrum. And if fans are going, what the huh? It's the same reaction that Michael or some of those, some of her team had. I love the fact that Landry just sits there. They keep doing cutaways to her listening. She never opens her mouth about the whole thing, but that he's defending this, and whether he needed to or not, he gets very defensive about, you know, or you're a moron. You can't understand the intricacies of all this. And she doesn't say, I know it already, but she starts putting it together because she understands root word syntax, but she understands the English language. But, she had a, if not dubious reaction, at least to now, what is this? And, you know, that's where everybody, that's the point of view of the audience. She's the eyes of the series. So if fans are having that reaction, that's fine. That's what the audience should be doing, because it is a ridiculously new concept. But it's a very Star Trek concept. It's a very cool concept. Now, I don't know
it's
if that's
what
the real.
It's a very science fiction concept.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's what the real Paul Stamets is after. If he's just, I haven't read that. Maybe you do. But if that's really what he's looking at mushrooms as a way to propulse a faster than light travel, or if he's just looking at all the uses of spores in unconventional ways, or just trying to look at their properties or whatever. Yeah. But because they talk about, what is it? He's an astro, whatever that term for a mushroom
he's
scientist
an astromycologist.
Is. Yes. If Stamets is the real Stamets is a mycologist, let's make sure that we know that Lieutenant Stamets is an astro my college.
Well, Larry, don't you remember that original series? Don't you remember that original series episode when the story called for the ship's astromycologist to beam down with them somewhere?
No. Yeah, no, I did. Back to our central point, I totally thought of the Iconian gateways. And again, if they weren't I didn't think they were the literal gateways, but if they're on that plane of technology. Hey, the Romulans use a black hole for the center of their warp drives. They don't use
antimatter. Singularity. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Singularity.
Really dangerous. Mm-hmm. Much more dangerous than spores.
And when you start talking about double singularities, that's when it really gets tricky.
That's how you soup up a warbird, right? You you put a second singularity in there.
Look at her, Dad. She's got double singularities. Whoa, son. Excuse me. Romulan voice. Okay.
That explains why she's got that big tail fin on the back of the ship. So, all right. Okay. Well, let's move on to one more thing. And this is a different kind of storytelling. I was just noticing that when I see people who are really having issues with these episodes, I notice a pattern. And it seems that a lot of the angst comes down to people who don't like this style of storytelling. They want more Next Generation style episodes of Star Trek, which is understandable. That's what we all love. We're Star Trek fans. But this show is being made in 2017, and it is being told more in line with present-day television, present-day shows. It's exactly what I expected, personally, which was one long story. The idea of having a prologue and then a pilot, and then you go into the story, because I feel like the first two episodes were a prologue.
Right.
And then context is for Kings is the pilot episode. And now we're going to find out what the rest of the story is. That makes sense to me in a modern storytelling setting. It's really different than what's happened in Star Trek in the past. But it seems like a lot of people they don't like this, and they don't like the idea of the captain not being the main character and the story being told through the eyes of a lower ranked character. And now, and this is a twist none of us anticipated, not only is the main character not the captain, she doesn't even have a rank anymore at the moment. She's not even in Starfleet anymore. She was thrown out of Starfleet for mutiny. Now, she may get a rank again under Lorca. I think it's probable that she'll get a uniform and a rank and all that.
But I think that's got to be coming. Yeah.
That's just a different way of telling a story. And I saw David Gerald mention the other day that he said, it looks like Discovery might shape up to be a good show. I just don't know why they are calling it Star Trek.
Oh.
And that plays into a lot of the comments that I hear from fans, which is that the story's interesting. The show's good, but it just doesn't feel like Star Trek to them. But I think it's very Star Trek. It's just a different kind of storytelling.
I think people are letting their framing get in the way of enjoying this. And I'm not being a blanket cheerleader for the show. I still want to see them work into blue, gold, and red pajamas and the touchscreens. But think of it this way. We've already talked about this to some degree. The business model is different. We were talking about the Klingon translations, and I said that was a very bold move, because if you had to keep people watching through the first commercial and not turn off because it was free. There's a business thing that I've learned the last few years that I've put my toe into business. And it's like, sometimes when you're creative, you kind of grimace a little bit about charging people for things, but there's a respect.
That's true.
Customers who pay for something have more respect than people who get it for free. Respect for the product. They may love it, but they may walk away from something they got free. Whereas if they're invested in the product, if they're financially invested in the product, they're not so quick to walk away. And the fact that the paradigm of, oh no, we can't have 15 minutes of Klingon subtitles, being slowly delivered, they'll all turn away. That's not part of the formula anymore. The fact that the pilot has to jump in, like the Orville did. The Orville jumped in and introduced all the characters, just like Next Gen did, just like, Voyager and all that did. That's the paradigm of, we have to keep them watching past the first commercial, past the first half hour, past the first episode. We got to have them come back the next week, or else our ad rates on these commercials are going to fall. And if they fall too much and we're, you know, if people aren't watching the show, then the show is out of here in three episodes or six.
Yeah.
Or we won't make the 13, you know, you won't get a back order. That's not the paradigm going on here because of the business model. The whole season's been paid for up front. It's all been written. It's all been structured. So that's supposed to be liberating. That's supposed to be a freedom. And I mean, it's almost like, I don't know what else to do unless they're attacking. If CBS All Access ran a little disclaimer at the beginning, only instead of saying, you know, caution, the following program contains scenes of, it might be caution, the following program contains scenes of extremely relaxed storytelling and exposition.
That would be an interesting.
Be aware
disclaimer.
That this is not your father's Star Trek format. Not you know, concept. It's still, people want to talk about being dark. Well, I say, well, I think the lights at the end of the tunnel, it's just going to be even brighter when you finally get out of this extra dark tunnel. But the fact, the pick that people having a picture, but the having a problem with the storytelling and the structure is, it's determining why some of these things we've talked about. It's determining why. But it's also a new paradigm. The other thing is, I'd almost like to ask, not that I'm an ageist at all or any other kind of ist, but I'd like to know what's the demographic of the people who are doing the complaining, because part of the mission here is to compete with, and when people say compete with Game of Thrones, I don't mean have slow motion, gory death, you know, incest, rape, blood spurting in slow motion moments. Talking about though big epic scope, money spent on the screen, with the pace, the luxury to be fast, be slow, take on, go to five different, you know, settings before you come back to one of them again for the second time. Talking about epic scope story and talking about this blur between what we always think of as TV and what we think of as film, this whole new realm that these shows exist in, where motion picture people are thrilled to come in and work in it because it's not like crank it out TV on a crappy little budget. And all of those things are what's at play here. And people who are appreciating the storytelling are all caught up in that. Now, if you have issues with paying for the service or there's canon things, I understand those. But people who have a problem with that, it's almost like the people, the original series folks who could not adjust to Next Generation, and we've talked about this so often, but the upshot of all that was, Next Generation was made in the 80s with people who were used to ensemble shows, and as creaky and wobbly as the storytelling was the first year or two of Next Generation, you didn't confuse it with the look of original series. I think a lot of this has gotten smoothed over in people's rosy memories.
Yeah.
But the Next Gen, even at its wobbly primary days, is way different in tone and style and editing and acting and everything else than the original series was. And all the people who were used to that in 1987 had no problem with it. And the Next Generation numbers wound up being so huge that the people who went underground were it was like a moot point. And CBS All Access is counting on that same thing to happen, because if they hadn't, all the people who are used to watching TV now would never give it a try. And those numbers are supposedly way huger than even the fan base who would be, you know, disaffected.
Yeah. Well, there is at the moment still this feeling that there's a movement of, if we diss it and we complain about it, then we'll change it. You know, CBS will
decide. They're filming the finale right now.
I know.
It's being wrapped.
But there is, if you read the comments, there is this feeling still that somehow we're going to turn the ship by complaining about it. They're going to take it off CBS All Access. They're going to change the tone of the story, you know, change the characters. They're going to stop making references to things that we think violate canon because we're complaining about it. Where in reality, the number of people who are complaining is much smaller than the number of people who are saying, hey, I'm really enjoying this.
Well, right.
But at the end of the day, I think you're right. Format is key. And this format of telling a story, not in an episodic format, not even in the DS9 ongoing format, but truly like you've picked up a book and the book's been written and you've just got to read it through to the end. That's what we're getting. And that's something I think people aren't accustomed to. They weren't expecting it from Star Trek, and it's going to take some time to adjust to it. But I still think in the end, down the road, people will look back and they will appreciate this story, the same way people now love Enterprise, but they complained and hated it at the time.
Right.
Well, Larry, there are a lot of other points that I would love to chat about. A couple of them just popped in my head right now, such as what would Enterprise have been like if it had been launched in the age of social media where we had Twitter and Facebook and we had podcasts and all the stuff like we have now. But let's save that discussion for another time because we're about to hit 2 hours in our discussion of Discovery.
Well, I'll top you with one little thing. What if Enterprise had existed today and been allowed to have that whole first season when they're still on? Talk about your slow motion setups of exposition, but they'd been allowed to have that first year on the ground.
They probably would have been allowed to if it were made today and it were on CBS All Access. Because
what if Voyager had been allowed to have its whole last year back at Earth? Yeah. Finally, this whole thing about Burnham, this is what one thing I would say real quick. Burnham's point of view and how that's been controversial and how she was in prison and had no rank and all that stuff. All you have to do is go back and think, how would the Voyager caretaker pilot have been if the whole thing had been through Tom Paris's eyes?
Yeah.
We went through his Maquis, his Starfleet stumbles, his Admiral dad yelling at him, right? And dissing him and disowning him and him feeling horrible. And we see him stumble from Starfleet into the Maquis and then finally into prison. And we go through 2 hours of that. And then at the end of it, he's out with his ankle bracelet and this captain shows up and says, oh, I'm going to go. Hey, I want you to join my crew. And he goes, are you serious? And she goes, yes. And then we get 5 minutes at the end where she's like, okay. And they all hate him. They all hate him. They all hate him. They all leer at him and stare at him. And then, oh my God, they get sucked to another part of the galaxy. Wow. Who knows what's going to happen now? Maybe I can be of help. I mean, that's all we're seeing here. We just took Caretaker and like pulled it inside out a little bit.
Yeah, it's a good point.
We substituted sporocysteins for spores. That's what we did.
Yeah, we just shortened it like editors do.
Yeah. Anyway.
I do have to say, well, that's a great point, Larry, but I do have to say that is the worst Captain Janeway imitation I've ever heard.
I did it on the run, Chris. I'm sorry.
Okay, we're going to wrap up and let everyone go here. It's been a lot of fun talking about Discovery, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing here on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
For an opening episode to get that relationship, like you could see that crew really had been working together for 7 years, which is so not normal for a launch, for a first episode, right? Because you've got the odds, but they seemed to have working forever together. The camaraderie that they had, the trust that they have with each other.
To the journey!
And then, you know, they're all up on the bridge and everyone's like, oh, what's B'Elanna doing with her day off? And Tom's like, oh, she's binge-watching Bill Nye. She's been there, you know, in her PJs since 8 o'clock this morning.
I can picture she's been watching Bill Nye all day. Tom comes home and she says to Tom, you know, Tom, have you ever thought about wearing a bow tie?
But if he's on the bridge and says all that, would Captain Janeway know who Bill Nye the Science Guy is?
Yeah. It's Janeway.
The 602 Club.
So I graduated from high school in 1984. So this film came out in my, sophomore year in high school? So that was like prime formative years for me. This is, you know, this and Mad Max were the R-rated movies that me and all of my friends wanted to go see.
Meta Treks.
It knows to point that out and say, that's red. You know, it will correctly identify the red shirt as red, but really perceives it like we perceive blue.
I knew Kirk should have wore his green tunic when he went to fight the Gorn.
Yeah, it would have made all the difference.
It would have made all the difference.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows, including our dedicated Discovery show, The Edge, which airs 5 days a week, in fact, because it's a main show and 4 sub-shows. You can find all of our shows everywhere you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps like Overcast or Pocket Casts. And you can also stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link. Now, we would love to hear your thoughts on the things we discussed today. There are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference. That's our closed listeners group on Facebook. If you're not yet a member, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right on up. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. You can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and select the Ready Room. That will come right to me by email. And you can also find the network on Twitter. Our username there is TrekFM, and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. That's our main brand page. So Larry, we're coming out of convention season. You've been very busy. And now that we're into October, what do you have coming up?
Well, I'll keep it short, Chris. LarryNemechek.com. A lot of things are happening. Yeah, conventions have tailed off. The big thing, aside from keeping Trekland Tuesdays live going every week at 1 o'clock Pacific on my Facebook page at Larry Nemechek's Trekland, the big thing I'm really excited about is that October 18th, it's the second anniversary of Portal 47. And I'm very excited already about that. Yes. And it's growing and growing and growing. And to mark, as we did last year, to mark the anniversary, I'm having an open house. It's a virtual open house. So I'm just
now,
saying,
do you have virtual cookies and juice for people?
Yes, yes. Okay. Virtual fortune cookies, virtual virtual blueberries, virtual Kelpian blueberries. And our guests this year, it's the 30th anniversary. It's kind of an interesting bit here because we're all excited about Discovery, or most of us are. And but it's also the 30th anniversary of Next Generation. A lot of people are really loving the 30th anniversary vibe. So my guest this year for this open house, which anybody can come to if they come over and register at LarryNemechek.com, the actual page is /anniversary-2017, but come over. There's three or four times you can get to the link. It'll be all over Facebook. It'll be in my emails going out. So it'll be easy to go if you get to my Facebook at Larry Nemechek's Trekline or LarryNemechek.com. But my guest is David Late Night Livingston, who was there, who was line producer, was doing budgets the very first days with Gene and Bob Justman on The Next Generation, and then who segued into being a director and wound up directing more episodes of the Berman era than anyone else. In fact, I counted this up today. My count is, and I talk about TV hours, now they're 43 minutes or whatever, or episodes or whatever, but I split everything into hours. And if it was a 2 hour or something, I still count that as 2 hours, but instead of titles. And avoid that. But there were 620 hours of Berman era TV for the four series. And David directed 62 of them. He directed one out of every 10 Berman era.
Yeah. I was going to say episodes. That's easy math. Even I can do that math.
I thought you could. I mean, it was one of those fun facts I stumbled across today, assuming all my other edition is all there. Anyway, that's
and
October 18th.
If I said that, Stamets would go, are you trying to show everyone how smart you are?
Because I am not in awe. I am not in awe.
Such I'm a not in thing. Awe of I your math skills.
I am shocked by being not in awe of this. But yeah, October 18th, it's a Wednesday night. It's a bonus that I did. It's our anniversary open house. And I hope everybody will get over to my Facebook page or LarryNemechek.com and click on the link and just register, just leave your email and then you'll get the sign in directions. It's over freeconferencecall.com. It's not Astrosporistian science. It's pretty straightforward. And you can watch the slideshow with David and it'll be awesome. And you can see how a big chunk of Portal works hands on and have an awesome guest. We'll have an hour, maybe a little over an hour. And I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Very good.
Otherwise, you know, it's at Larry Nemechek at Twitter and my YouTube channel. I'm trying to get a lot more people to subscribe on YouTube. I just did an interview with David Mack, by the way, about Desperate Hours from Vegas. Put that up. And then Larry Nemechek's Trekland at Facebook and my Instagram. And I have a new podcast coming this fall. We don't have a delivery date yet, a start date. But with Roddenberry, it's called The Trek Files. It's just 15 minutes a week. And we take out a document from Gene's archives and put it in context. And a lot of them are from the 70s and the 80s from a lot of unexplored country and undiscovered country from there. And that's going to start sometime this fall. So I'm really excited about that. And then some more things coming down the line.
I thought you were going to say, we take a document out of the archives and I read it in my Captain Janeway voice.
No, we want people to listen, Chris. We don't want to lose them before the first commercial.
All right. So yeah, go check out Larry's interview with David Mack. And also, for even more David Mack, tomorrow after we're recording this, but it will already be out by the time you hear this Ready Room, David is on Literary Treks with Bruce and Dan, talking all about Desperate Hours as well. So between the convention interview and the Literary Treks interview, you can get all the behind the scenes you can imagine about Desperate Hours. All right. Well, I don't have nearly as much stuff going on as you do, Larry. I will, as usual, be riding
Chris,
a train
I don't
back
believe
and forth
that.
To work. Instead of a train, I'm going to shuttle called Disco One to take me to work. But when I'm not doing that, I am podcasting a little bit. You can hear me on Notes from the Edge, which is a sub-show of our Star Trek Discovery podcast, The Edge. That comes out every weekend on Saturday. And I look for connections between Discovery and what we're seeing in the stories and the broader Star Trek franchise, including the literary universe. I also do The Orb with Matthew Rushing, which is our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. And then you can find my writing about Star Trek over on the official website at StarTrek.com. And if you want to find me on Twitter, my username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can also find me on Facebook and pretty much everywhere in social media under that name. And I'm in the Babel Conference on Facebook. But, you know, really Twitter is probably the best place to hit me up because I do like to chat on Twitter. I'd like to take a moment and thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room. Now, I haven't been doing The Ready Room very frequently, so I want to give a thank you to the associate producers who have been supporting the show for a long time and who were supporting it when I was last doing it regularly. And that's Norman C. Lau, Renee Roberts, Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, K. Elizabeth Shaw, Tim Robertson, David Shuford, and Ju Kim. Thank you, guys, for supporting the network and supporting the show, and also kind of hanging in there with me through all of my trials and tribulations as I've gone through my eye surgeries and health issues and all the different things that have kept me off mic for a long time.
I know, but the CGI was awesome.
Yeah, it was. Well, technology's getting really, really good, Larry.
In your tribulations scenes. Yeah.
Exactly. So if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows going here on the network and help me keep the Ready Room going and even become an associate producer, if you like, you can do that through Patreon. That's how we support the network. That's how we keep everything going. And it does cost quite a lot of money for us to produce these shows and host and distribute them every month because we push out over 7 terabytes, maybe getting close to 8 terabytes of data every month. And that does cost quite a bit. So if you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can get all the details on how to become a patron of the network, the perks we have for you, like our special website, Patron Zone, that's patron.zone, and we put early releases up there and other special content. And we have the Patrons Roundtable, where you can get on mic with hosts and other patrons and talk Star Trek, and we put that out in the master feed for everyone to listen to. We have a lot of different perks like that. And all the details are there. Patreon.com/TrekFM. And I really appreciate any support you can give us. And I do hope you'll join us and become part of the team. Well, Larry, I didn't think we would talk for 2 hours about Discovery today. But then
again,
you need
to do a Ready Room more often, Chris. This is...
Yeah. But then again, when you and I get together, we tend to talk for about 2 hours anyway. So that's it was true. A lot of fun. I'm glad we had a chance to catch up with each other on our thoughts on the topics we talked about before the launch and just see where we are now that we're 3 episodes, soon to be 4 by the time this airs, into Discovery.
Yeah, Chris, I mean, we should not let this much time go by again. This show is going to be rolling on every week. There's going to be a lot to say down the line in the future. And I, you know me, I love not talking about the same old, and looking at some of these different angles. But I think 2 hours has done us. I think it's time to stick a Gorn skeleton in it, because the Ready Room is done.